Thank you very much, Moshe. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm going to try to be really brief because I want to hear what my discussant has to say, and perhaps more importantly, it's almost time for lunch. About two sentences of the history of this work. A few years ago, I was working with a colleague on credit risk modeling, and we recognized that perhaps the math used in credit risk modeling could be applied to an insurance problem where instead of the time of default, you've got the time of the death of a person. We gave this problem to a PhD student, and he looked into it and soon discovered that most of the heavy lifting for what he wanted to do had been done by Scott Richard, my discussant. But nevertheless, he made some modifications and extensions, and then I was presenting this work we did together in Portugal, and there's some folks, these three others that you see in the current paper, picked up on this, and we moved the ball up the field a few yards further. So what I'm going to be able to, this is the underlying math is a lot of it, but you can see that in the paper. But it's the model itself is fairly simple, and so I'm going to describe the model and then show the results, and that'll probably be as much as I want to say. So here's the basic problem. We've got a wage earner. Think of this person as coming out of grad school, with hot prospects for a job and wants to do some family planning, and he wants to divide his or her future income in three different directions, consumption, and then savings for investment, and the third way is to purchase life insurance. Now, we're going to be developing an expected utility model. So the three things that will be captured with this model in terms of utility are, first of all, the level of consumption during the working years. Now, this wage earner, by the way, has fixed his time of retirement in advance. So in a little example I'll be showing, you can think of this person starting his employment at age 25 and determined to retire at age 65. So he wants to, first of all, capture the utility of consumption during his working years. Unfortunately, he might die before age 65, so he wants to also take into account the size of his bequest, in the event of death before retirement. And finally, there's the utility of what the size of the estate will be at age 65 if he lives that long. So we're going to set up a dynamic programming model that will determine the optimal value of these, how to divide up this income stream over the course of his working life. Real briefly, the two contributors to the foundations of this model are in the room today. Of course, Professor Yari. Another, of course, is Professor Merton, who famous for, among other things, his work in consumption investment modeling with using dynamic programming, but without any involvement of the random lifetime of the individual or insurance. These things were pulled together then by Scott Richard, and he extended Merton's result to include insurance. And in fact, like I said, the model that I'll be telling you is just a modest extension of Scott's model, which was done way back in 1975. So my student was Jin-Chun Ye, and he developed a model. Now, there's a key distinction between the model I did with a student and Scott's model. We both had my sentence here is a little bit misleading. We both had a fixed planning horizon. However, for Scott, it was served as an upper bound in the lifetime of the individual. For me, like I said, it's the time when the wage earner intends to retire, if he lives that long. Then the in my student's case, what we did then, there was only one risky security available for investment in addition to a riskless bank account. What we do in the current model is extend this to having two or more risky securities. So this is a little flow chart then for the flow of money. We assume the income rate, I of t, is fixed and deterministic and known in advance. So that's a little bit of a heroic assumption that would be nice to relax. And the wage earner divides this up into three categories. He purchases life insurance at the rate P of T. He consumes at the rate C of T. And then the balance of the money, I of T, is invested or saved. Now the savings then is invested among a bank account with a riskless deterministic interest rate that's known in advance, and then and divided up among n risky securities, which are modeled with a classical Merton kind of model of multivariate geometric Brownian motion. So, okay, like I do, just highlight some of the things, some of which I already, well, the wage earner has, of course, a random lifetime, and so that's assumed to have a density function, and associated with it is the hazard rate function, lambda. Okay, now what about the life insurance market? It's like term insurance with the length of the term being 5 seconds. It's an infinitesimal kind of situation. The wage earner will purchase insurance at the rate P of T. Now, if he dies in the next second, the bequest or the life insurance benefit will be P of T over 8 of T. So 8 of T is beta, another deterministic function, which is known in advance. And P of T, of course, is one of the decision variables. And then, assuming that no insurance will be purchased then after retirement, it's just during the years while he's working and still alive. Okay, so just to summarize the decision variables, we've got really n plus two decision variables. We've got the consumption rate at any particular time while still alive and working, and the premium payment rate. And then for the savings, we have to describe how that's allocated among the risky securities, and whatever's not allocated among the risky securities is put in the bank account. So we have capital N plus two of these decision variables. Other variables of interest, current wealth, that's just sort of obvious. The legacy or bequest upon early death will equal the value of the investments at that time plus the insurance payment. And then a third quantity of considerable interest and importance in our results is the value of human capital, denoted B of T. This will turn, I'll show you later, maybe not, if we probably won't have time, but it's a deterministic function of the various parameters, and roughly speaking, it's a discounted value of the future income, but the discount rate that's involved is a little bit curious. It's not just the interest rate, which is R, which you'd expect, but it's plus the eta that determines. Remember, that's a deterministic function associated with the insurance company's payout upon death. So the wage earner's objective, okay, well, some might quarrel with the fact I'm assuming a utility of the bequest upon early death, but we're going to have the expected utility with these three components, the consumption rate, or actually the consumption rate based upon cumulative consumption, then the utility of the value of the estate upon retirement if the individual lives that long, and the value of the bequest if the person dies before retirement. So we'll be using dynamic programming to compute the maximum expected utility function. Bad news is that there's only one case where we could get an explicit solution. Otherwise, one has to use numerical methods to compute the maximum expected value function, maximum expected utility function, and from that, whether it's computed numerically or not, you can readily derive the optimal strategies. So what I'm going to proceed now is to show you the one case where we could get an explicit solution. And this is where the various utility functions are not only all of this CRRA form, power, you know, see it's the value of the underlying variable raised to the power of gamma, then with a discount factor. A very strong and unfortunate assumption that we found necessary is not only that the three utility functions have this form, but that the risk aversion parameter gamma is the same for all three. But nevertheless, being the mathematician that I am and my co-workers are, we'll have to live with that. And so here's the optimal strategies. You see in the first, well, in all three cases, more or less you've got, well, firstly, certainly in the first and the third case, you've got the optimal strategy depends on the sum of the current wealth, X, whatever that is, and the current value of the human capital. So it's like, and here's one sort of insight that emerges is that if you're just this 25-year-old that's just starting out and the X might be zero or if not negative with loans to pay off the educational expenses, you know, presumably a B of T, you know, the future is bright, you've got to wear sunglasses, so that would be really big. And so this, for a young person starting out, they should maybe act aggressively with their decisions. In the middle case, it's a little bit harder to interpret the insurance premium purchase rate P because it involves this parameter D. But the D is a deterministic function depending on the various parameters, which takes a value between 0 and 1. Okay, now these, I'm going to show you a couple of slides which aren't in the paper. But these are, when you compute this optimal insurance purchase rate function P, this will give the, this is like a slice. You hold the wealth constant at some value, I forget what it is, and then you look at how P varies, what insurance purchase rate varies with the individual's age. And the solid line is sort of our baseline case. So the main thing to, so the first thing is look at the solid line. And, well, this makes some considerable sense here, or coincides with reality, I suppose, where when you start off it's with a young, you know, beginning work, it's fairly small, then builds up to a peak, and then declines, and then falls off back down to zero. In this case, we're comparing two interest rates, and sort of intuitively, the higher the interest rate, then the less one would spend on insurance. But I'm going to skip a couple of these. Lambda. I guess, no, that's guys. One guy's healthier than another in this case. Now here, the eta case, remember this reflects the how much you get from the insurance company upon early death. So remember, eta is in the denominator. So the bigger the eta, the less one will get for based on what one was paying. And you'll see that, okay, so the dotted line is a bigger eta. And so the individual is forced to sort of ends up being optimal for this person to have to, you know, in a sense, insurance is more expensive. So in fact, this person will pay more for insurance. But you notice something interesting, right at just before retirement, see a couple of little dots there actually become negative. So with this big enough eta, it becomes optimal for this person to sell insurance when he's approaching retirement. So he's collecting, so that's an annuity, I guess. And here with an even bigger eta, this is a lot more pronounced. Okay, so now in the paper there's this little example where it's we show this two-dimensional picture. So on this axis along here, this is the person's age, from 25 to 65. Along this axis, it's the sum of the person's wealth and human capital at any particular point in time. So as you move along this dimension, of course, that's deterministic, but on the other dimension, there's randomness because of the randomness of the investments. Well, I'm going to skip this one, but you know, analyzing these functions, you can, coinciding with some of those diagrams I showed, you can make some conclusions about monotonicity and so forth. Let's see. Maybe I'll mention, highlight this third point here, namely, for it turns out, according to this model, that with typically for a person starting out, it might be optimal to borrow money, buy stocks on margin. Now here's another result which wasn't actually in the paper, but this is entirely analogous to this classical mutual fund result that is dating back to the early years of financial theory, whereby, you know, for that it says that, okay, you turn the Markowitz model, your allocation among the risky securities will all be by the same proportions for all the individuals. So it's as if there's one mutual fund which everybody could buy, although different individuals with different risk tolerances will divide their money between the bank account and the mutual fund in different ways. But we get the same result, and the intuition is actually what it was in the Markowitz case, that there's no correlation in our model between the risky securities and the person's lifetime. Now, I was thinking if you're Steve Jobs, it might be different, but most people aren't in that category. Let's see. Oh, then I'll maybe stop here to say that, this last slide, two remarks. Going back to the preceding remark on a mutual fund result, that sort of says that this extension, which I did with these fellows in Portugal, doesn't add much to the result that I did with my student, where we just had one risky security. Now, my last remark, though, is to point out that there's one little section in the paper which I would urge you to ignore. We were trying to make a comparison between the guy in my original problem and a second wage earner who, either by choice or otherwise, does not buy any or sell any insurance, and then to see how maybe the consumption differed and so forth. But we goofed up and we left out of this the fact that that the bequest in this case upon early death is simply equal to the value of the investment. So we're going to remedy that for the future, but ignore it in the paper that you now have. So I'll stop there and turn it over. Oops.
Scott Richards, to give him a proper introduction. Finance at the Wharton School of Business at the University of Pennsylvania. He previously understand that he was responsible for mortgage research at Goldman Sachs. So can we blame anything on you?
I got out when I could.
Scott got trained at MIT, and he's a doctor at Harvard, which is related to the very classical paper we all read. So please welcome Scott Richard.
Well, thank you. It's my pleasure to be here, and I am going to talk about the following agenda. We have, the first item is motivation for my classic paper. Classic was Moshe's word. I think he meant to say old, but was trying to be nice. All right. Well, it made me feel old in any case. This is the 1975 paper people are referring to. And like Professor Yari, he wanted me to talk a little bit about what was in my mind when I wrote the paper, and then to talk about where we are now. I don't even know how to pronounce all these names. Duarte, Pinheiro, Pinto, and Pliska, I got it. I call it the DPPP paper, all right? And then thoughts on the research agenda, which really makes me feel old when you start talking and pontificating about where we should all be going. Okay. Well, it all begins with Yari. This is the classical paper where we take the classical life cycle consumption and savings problem and add a stochastic lifetime, bequest motives, and an insurance or annuity market. Take your pick how you want to look at it. And the critical insight, as far as I was concerned, is he shows that you can complete the market by adding these annuity or insurance contracts. And then, lo and behold, consumers now can insure their uncertain lifetime. And when they can do that, they behave as if their total wealth is equal to the sum of their market capital and human capital. And really nothing changed from the rest of the neoclassical literature. So this is a great breakthrough. The other great pillar was Merton. And he did several things. First of all, he introduced a new modeling technology. He introduced these diffusion processes as models for crisis, the Ito processes. And that paper stimulated a vast new set of research, or in fact, a whole genre of research in the financial industry. Perhaps the peak of that was the Black-Scholes problem, which got solved. In fact, Merton was one of the guys who helped solve it with because Black and Scholes and Merton were all together at MIT. Okay, so this technology proved to be very useful, and for a young guy like me at the time, it was irresistible. You had to learn it. So that was one thing. What Merton came up with were dynamic programming solutions for optimal consumption and investment, and then he had ignored, as anybody would who's writing the first paper in this, he had ignored uncertain lifetime and wages. Okay. He comes up with the famous portfolio separation theorem. What Stan was talking about is the mutual fund theorem, which goes back to Markowitz. It's the basis of the capital asset pricing model, that consumers can, faced with many, many risky assets, will actually all be happy with two mutual funds, one the risk-free asset and one the portfolio of all the risky assets. Bill Sharpe identified that as the market portfolio, and away we went. Okay, and as Stan was showing you, for the constant relative risk aversion utility functions, you can get nice explicit solutions. All right. What got preserved? Well, I stood on the shoulders of giants, Yari and Merton. Most people stand on the shoulders of giants to see further. I did it so I could pick the low-hanging fruit. All right. So here's what I did. I combined the ideas of Merton and Yari by adding non-stochastic wage income, and that's an important thing. It's non-stochastic. Bequest motives, an insurance market, and stochastic lifetime to a Merton economy. Okay. So it was easy enough to do, and it needed doing. As in Yari's model, consumers act as if they had total wealth equal to the sum of their human capital and physical capital, just what Stan showed you. Human capital is calculated by discounting future income at a rate equal to the sum of the risk-free rate and the cost of insurance. A little something different here. The cost of insurance is not actuarially fair in my model. There's a wedge there, which exists in the real world. It's not necessary to be there. okay? It could just be the force of mortality. And a few more results. Portfolio separation theory is still valid, but with total wealth substituted for market wealth. And depending on their total wealth and age, consumers can be either buyers or sellers of life insurances over the life cycle. Okay? So you have the beginnings of a supply side in this story. The portfolio construction of Merton's CRRA utility, constant relative risk aversion utility, is basically unchanged, so I'm not going to go into that. All right. Now, the current paper adds two features to the model. Now, it also has much slicker mathematics than I had. They are much more, the math in there is a lot more elegant. But I didn't focus on the math. I'm going to focus on the economics. Okay. So there's two more. There's two new features. There was no fixed maximum lifetime. I like that. You can maybe live to be 1,000. I'm not sure that it'll affect planning very much, but it's in there. Okay. The other one is they added a fixed retirement date, and that's the end of the planning, after which non-stochastic wage income goes to zero. Okay. They introduce a new utility function, B, of wealth and time for requests prior to retirement. And here's my constructive comment. We need to figure out where this B came from, because implied within their framework is a utility function for wealth prior to retirement, which is just a discounted utility of wealth at retirement and consumption between now and then. Okay? And that would be exactly what you would get, say, out of the Yari model or the Merton model or my model. Right. So it's not that it can't be. I would want a motivation for why people have a different utility of wealth prior to retirement than they would get by just discounting their future utility of wealth at retirement and the consumption in between. Okay. So if that could be motivated, then there could be, and if we could see empirically that that actually occurs, then that could be an important addition to the literature. All right. Where should we go? Well, the first thing is stochastic wage income. People get sick. People lose their jobs. We don't have to emphasize that in the current economic environment. To the extent that wage losses can be insured, then we should get very similar results to everything we've gotten before. Nothing new is going to happen. So the interesting thing is, if not, if consumers will suffer welfare losses then, and there will be distortions in their consumption and portfolio decisions. Okay. Now this is a place where maybe life insurance markets or annuity markets might help to mitigate some of these distortions. And I haven't seen any literature on this. There may be out there. Okay. But I don't know about it. But it'd be a useful place to ask to what extent. Now, what I'm thinking about are things like this. You buy more insurance now than might be optimal because you could get sick later. And it's not that that will lead to a change in mortality, but it will be, you won't be able to take the same level of work that you can now. And so you can hedge some of it. Okay? So I don't know whether that could be, but it's at least something that would be a fruitful area for more research. We need a model of the supply of insurance policies. Now, I know I've been out of touch with this literature. I mean, my paper was written 35 years ago, and the work was done a little bit before that. All right? So maybe this is a solved problem. If it is, I apologize. Maybe one of you in this room has already solved it. So I apologize to you if that's the case. But I did what everybody does now. I did a Google search, and I didn't come up with anything. Okay. We assume that individuals write policies directly to other consumers. In reality, there are insurance companies who supply these policies. Here are some questions. What determines the spread over the actuarially fair rate? Is it due to tax advantages on accumulations, which are important in the sense that whatever accumulates inside the insurance policy is not taxed. Now, there's competition for that now. There's Roth IRAs, for example, and IRAs. Other questions. What are the barriers to entry that prevent these spreads from being competed away? Or another way of saying it is, you know, why are the agents paid so much? Regulations such as capital requirements, certainly that's one place to look. The other place to look, state laws. In Pennsylvania, where I'm from, if you want to refinance, and this isn't life insurance, this is your insurance on the title insurance, if you want to refinance, the rate that you pay is determined by the legislature, and the companies that can offer the policy have to be approved by the state as well. And I'm a little skeptical, of course, that there might be some money that changed hands when that happened. All right. The other place, and this is my Carnegie Mellon training. My colleagues were Bob Lucas and Ed Prescott and Finn Kidlin and people like that. Well, and they said, look, we have to combine the consumer problem with the model of insurance companies so we can study policy questions. So what does that mean? Well, we have to add heterogeneous consumers, okay? There has to be, in general, for the general equilibrium to be interesting, we have to have people who differ in their motives and in their wealth. And then we can ask questions. Well, for example, if we change the regulations on the insurance companies, so that moves both supply and demand, what will the new equilibrium look like? Are there better regulations? Can we improve consumer welfare? How would changes in tax rules affect the industry? For example, if the government, which now we now know needs a lot more revenue, said, "Well, we'll tax the accumulation," okay? How will that affect welfare? What will happen? I mean, it won't be good, but it won't be good for the insurance industry, and it won't be good for the people buying it. But maybe it might happen. Okay, my conclusion. Our life insurance markets or annuity markets are necessary for consumer welfare maximization. The imperfect insurance market introduced costs that reduce welfare, but they may be the best that can be done with our current regulatory environment. Who knows? That's what we have to figure out. That's why we need to start looking at the general equilibrium problem. And the field is very ripe for future research because, in my view, these supply and general equilibrium problems are the low-hanging fruit that haven't been picked. So, thank you very much.
Any questions from the audience? We have about 5 more minutes before lunch. Go ahead.
Completely leaves out, of course, the issue about life insurance being more important when you have a young family with children versus they don't. But that's my intuitive thought about it.
If there's not a complete annuities market to use, then you could have parents dealing with their kids on this on a risk-sharing basis, and then they have to anticipate the impact of deals that their kids will make with their kids, and their kids will make with their kids. Now, the barrel model kind of had everybody playing Nash as a game between the parents and the kids, but there's nothing where you take the parents' transfer to me if I'm a kid is given, like, and they take my transfer to them is given, and you can get, under certain circumstances, a nice solution there in terms of a rising single dynasty family. But what happens if I'm really altruistic towards my kid and he's really altruistic towards me? You have no internal solution in some cases. So that's where I really realize that this Nash game may not be realistic. Maybe it's more like the two-person Nash bargaining solution that needs to be played. So people have the ability to reject transfers. They don't necessarily have to take what's put on their plate. You know, I realized this when I was, you know, having dinner with my mom, which is trying to keep the food on my plate. I said, no, I'll just take it. And so in that context, if you have me bargaining with my kids in the two-person Nash bargaining solution, and I anticipate the kid bargaining with his kid, and et cetera, et cetera, well, in some very special kind of Douglas world, you can get a closed form solution for all that. Otherwise, the whole thing is really complicated. So, and by the way, you don't have, with that other view of altruistic behavior between parents and kids, you don't get the Barrow regarding equivalence theorem coming through. So, Barrow regarding equivalence is predicated on a certain game that's being played, and it's a game that's seems to be unrealistic because it doesn't allow people to refuse gifts. So you get to this other framework, and then now you have an actual setting for the modeling it, but then it can become very complicated very quickly. So I'm not sure I'm saying anything upbeat here or downbeat, but within the downbeat, I guess.
What happens to my excuse?
The excuse you use could be a threat point. I mean, that's kind of the threat point is I eat my endowment. And you need your endowment. And that's why the government changes our endowment, changes the threat points, and changes the real equilibrium. Even though I'm altruistic towards you, and you may even be altruistic towards me.
Any other questions for either Scott or Ben, obviously, from the audience?
Could I add a comment to?
Sure.
I mean, we gave no thought whatsoever to a sort of game incorporating game theory thoughts in our modeling, but I would like to add, you know, sort of thoughts that I've popped into my mind listening to you folks, some of you folks this morning about modeling bequests. I mean, I'd just like to toss out the fact that my wife and I get great satisfaction from giving money essentially to our kids and grandkids while we're still far from death, and we have absolutely no thoughts of you know, getting anything tangible in return. We're budgeting money to check ourselves into an old folks' home when that time comes. So, some, you know, that maybe there's other people like us. I don't know. Okay.
I think they're all term insurance, and then they differ by the savings plan, and that's what it's all about. It's which savings plan makes sense and how much risk you want to bear. Variable annuities, for example, you're bearing the risk instead of the insurance company. And in each case, I think a lot of this is driven by individual taxes and estate planning motives.
So you're saying that if taxes were to somehow disappear magically, or we'd have a tax rate that's fair and uniform, all of these products wouldn't exist.
Less of them.
That's what I'm thinking about guaranteed insurability, ability to...
They're all renewable terms. Everything inside of those policies, if you look how their calculations are done, are always the term, renewable term. That's the only insurance actuarially that the companies write. And then on top of it, they put in the savings plans.
But you mentioned Black & Scholes earlier. Isn't there embedded optionality there, the ability to insure if you get sick or to buy more if you want? Or isn't that part of the story of the type of insurance policies that people get?
Yeah, I think that's also one of the reasons you don't see as much annuity. I agree with your statement, is that people want to hold on to the money because it gives them an optionality, because we can't sell the annuities. If there was a market to sell the annuities, they wouldn't need that optionality. I don't know why that market doesn't exist. I know why the market in life insurance doesn't
exist.
But how?
Well, I want to cash in my annuity policy. Why don't I cash in my annuity policy? Because I know I have to.
Yeah, I guess so. But the other side of the market, so that just would lead to a failure. I guess that's what you're saying. Yeah, the other side of the market, we'd just be in a lemon's law, in a lemon situation. So the market doesn't exist. Okay, that'll do.
Any other thoughts?